From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The first Americans could be just days away from getting a coronavirus vaccine. The FDA meets today to decide whether to issue an emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine. This is the next step after a panel of outside experts recommended yesterday that the government clear the way for immediate distribution. Let's bring in Dr. Lena Wen. She's a public health professor at George Washington University and an emergency physician. Dr. Wen, welcome back. It's always good to speak with you. This could be, I think it's fair to say, a watershed moment in history when we finally start to beat back this pandemic. So what's next? When will the first shots go into arms?
You're absolutely right. This is a monumental moment for us, especially as we're rounding on 3,000 deaths every day that we're seeing due to coronavirus. We could see the emergency use authorization given by the FDA as early as today. The CDC panel is also meeting to decide if there are any other restrictions that they would recommend when it comes to people who should be getting this vaccine. And we could see the first vaccines going into people's arms by early next week.
Wow. So let's talk about the actual recommendation here. It is for people over 16 years old, but not for younger children. It has not been tested on pregnant women, though some medical experts are saying that the decision on whether to get it should rest with women and their doctors.
Yeah, this is a very complex area because on the one hand, pregnant women and breastfeeding people were not included in the study. And so we really don't know the safety among for pregnant women. On the other hand, you also have, even among healthcare workers, you have 330,000 healthcare workers who are pregnant or postpartum. And you would not want to exclude these individuals from the benefits of the vaccine either. And so I think it would be a reasonable recommendation to not recommend that this vaccine be given to pregnant women, but if there are instances where somebody is particularly high risk, that individual is able to discuss with her doctor about whether it's suitable for her.
In the United Kingdom, where the vaccine has been given a green light already, officials are advising people with a history of significant allergic reactions not to get the vaccine. Now, in the U.S., the advisory panel added language recommending that people with allergies to vaccine components, they said they should not take it now. So what should we know about allergies and what the guidance is here in the U.S.?
So allergic reactions to vaccines do occur, although they are extremely rare. There are these two instances in the UK that occurred on the first day of vaccinations there that did raise some eyebrows. This does appear to be in individuals who already have severe known allergic reactions to the point that they carry an EpiPen with them. But we don't know what component of the vaccine they're allergic to. So I think it makes sense for people to use an abundance of caution. I think if people do have known allergies to vaccines, that they really discuss it with their physician in advance of getting the vaccine, know that they'll be getting the vaccine in a monitored setting. And so if something does happen, they can get an EpiPen used on them, and this is a treatable condition. But I also think that further studies need to be done so that we understand truly what is the component that people are allergic to, because many millions of Americans have allergies, and we don't want to dissuade them from getting the vaccine.
Okay, so this is the good news that we've been talking about. We're close here. We're very, very close. There was some disappointing vaccine news also today. GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi announced today that their vaccine is going to be delayed until the end of next year because it failed to deliver a sufficient immune response in older adults. What's your reaction to that news?
It's disappointing, but it is something that we thought could happen in vaccine trials. Vaccine development is highly complex, and we also know in this case that older individuals are more likely to suffer severe effects from coronavirus, and so a vaccine should work on older adults if it's going to be released, especially now that we have the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that appear to be so effective. And so ethically, you would not want to release another vaccine unless at least it comes close to the threshold of efficacy that we're seeing in these vaccines.
The fact is, though, we need as many vaccines as we can get because there's such a limited amount of production that every one of these companies can do in the early days of the vaccination process. So any sense of what it means in terms of getting the entire country vaccinated, because the government had decided to purchase about 100 million doses of a vaccine that now isn't going to come to market for a while.
I know, and this is one of these things that's really difficult because I think at the beginning, the government wanted to hedge its bets and wanted to put different, to put a lot of eggs in different baskets and not all the eggs in one basket. And so maybe have turned down doses of the Pfizer vaccine that now turns out is very highly efficacious. And so I think this is something that we need to see over time. I certainly agree that we need to get as many vaccines on the market as we can for not only the U.S., but for the world.
Dr. Wen, I'm going to have to leave it there. I'm really sorry to cut you off, but thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
When governments or major companies get hacked, one of the cybersecurity firms they call on is FireEye. Well, earlier this week, FireEye itself got hacked, and attackers made off with some of its most sophisticated software defense tools. The company believes the attack was done by a nation with top-tier offensive capabilities like Russia. And now there are concerns that what attacks like this could mean for the integrity of COVID-19 vaccine infrastructure. Joining us for more is Jim Lewis, a longtime cybersecurity expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jim, as I mentioned, FireEye is the firm companies call when they get hacked, Sony and Equifax, for instance. So how did FireEye find themselves the victim here?
No one is perfectly secure. Anyone can be hacked. You know, it's harder to do a company like FireEye, and I hear it was a relatively basic technique. One technique that always works is called phishing. You send 100 people an email that says, click here to see next year's bonuses. You can count on a couple of them making that mistake, even at a firm like FireEye. So even the best among us are still vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, do we know what the hackers stole, and is there any threat to the public?
You know, a company like FireEye, you hire them to pretend to be an attacker to find the vulnerabilities in your system. They're the red team. And so the attacker stole FireEye's red teaming tools, the way they attack companies. Probably not an immediate threat to the public. It's not like you're going to wake up tomorrow and see Vladimir Putin's face on your computer screen. But in the long term, yeah, this will be used to go after all sorts of companies, hospitals. How successful it will be, we don't know, but in the past, stealing this kind of tool has been useful to an attacker.
Okay, you used the example of Vladimir Putin. The U.S. seems to think Russia is behind this hack, but how do we know that?
There are a couple indicators that give it away. First of all, outside of the U.S. and the U.K., the Russians are the best in the world, and so I'm pretty confident that the British and NSA did not hack FireEye. That leaves Russia. Second, they've done this before. They did it against NSA in 2017. Mm-hmm. They're really good. They're really aggressive. They're very, very skilled. And all the tracks lead back to Moscow.
Why do you think Russia might be doing this now after really keeping a relatively low profile during the election?
Well, the low profile during the election was just in the kind of election interference that we saw in 2016. So I don't take the inactivity during the election as a sign that the Russians are slacking off. It means they have different interests. And one of the things they've been very interested in, of course, is COVID. COVID both to get the research, maybe to disrupt the supply chains, but also COVID as an opportunity. People are working from home. Your home networks aren't secure. It's a great opportunity for the FSB and the SVR, the Russian intelligence agencies.
I want to talk with you more about that potential threat. But you mentioned this NSA hack from a few years ago. It was an audacious one that led to many others, including one that locked British hospitals out of their own computer systems. Obviously, as you're saying, this is a big deal right now, considering this coronavirus pandemic. How vulnerable are our healthcare systems around the world?
Unfortunately, hospitals are not always centers of cybersecurity. It's not their job. And so we've seen a fair number of successful attacks. Most of them are what we call ransomware, where your computer locks up and you get a message saying, pay me money or else you can't use your computer. So we've seen an uptick of that during COVID. It's a good way to make money if you're a hacker. We might see more after this. And unfortunately, the defenses always aren't what we might hope.
On this issue of vaccine infrastructure, just a day after the FireEye hack, the European Medicine Agency, which is like the EU's FDA, said that they were hit with a cyber attack that resulted in the theft of some of Pfizer's vaccine data. Not to mention IBM actually found hackers getting cold chain storage companies and other key parts of the vaccine distribution infrastructure here in the U.S. Is this a coincidence? And do you think the goal is to disrupt these vaccine efforts or to steal
data to copy, formulas and technology.
Do me a favor, Tanya, and I want you to do two role-playing things. Think like a criminal for a minute. You're looking ahead, especially if you're a good criminal. You're going to want to get to the point where you can hold the vaccine distribution center hostage. That, to me, looked the thing that IBM found looked like cyber criminals thinking ahead. Now, for intelligence agencies, you know, imagine how many medals you would get if you showed up at your headquarters and said, I've gotten the secret formula for the COVID vaccine. It's been an object of desire for the Chinese, the Russians, some others, ever since this started. So what we're seeing is these are the visible signs of deep criminal and spying activity.
Jim Lewis is head of cybersecurity programs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Time magazine has named its person of the year, or rather persons, President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Time's editor-in-chief writes, the pair was chosen for showing that the forces of empathy are greater than division. And of course, people have a lot to say about this. Let's bring in Fimi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, for more. Welcome, Fimi.
Thank you. Hi, Tanya.
Time's short list for Person of the Year included the Movement for Racial Justice, President Donald Trump, healthcare workers, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. What kind of reaction are you seeing on social media about this choice?
Sure. Well, this is a historic Time selection of a president-elect and a vice president-elect weighing in on that selection. I found a post that was so popular, more than 8,000 people liked it. It's from Gray Connolly. Doctors, nurses, emergency workers spend almost the entire year trying to fight the worst pandemic in a century, with many dying in the process. And you award this bauble to a man who spent the year in a basement and a woman so unpopular she did not even make it to the primaries. 8,000 people agreed with that comment. Elsewhere online, there was a confusion between Time Person of the Year being two people. That's easy. That's very easy for me to clear up. Sometimes that title can go to a group or even an idea. One more reaction. I'm going to give this one to Michaela Rose, who posts, this will not age well, Tanya.
Oh, wow. You know, I'm thinking about something, Fimi. There's so much fanfare about these announcements every year.
Yeah.
What is the actual significance of Time picking a person of the year? I mean, we talk about it a lot, but what does it mean, if anything?
Well, there's more than just a cover. So if you're actually reading in a hard copy or reading online in Time, there are deep dive essays and films. For instance, Guardian of the Year goes to the frontline health workers, racial justice organizers, Athlete of the Year, LeBron James. Business Person of the Year, Eric Yuan. If you don't know who he is, he's the billionaire CEO and founder of Zoom, right? Yep. And then Entertainer of the Year, BTS, the South Korean K-pop group. You know, Tanya, that young people who are fans of K-pop are now screaming at the radio because I said BTS. I did it twice. But that is why it's...
Don't do a hashtag of BTS. They'll follow you forever.
Yeah. Then your tweets will never be seen again because the fans will be out there. So there's a much deeper dive. There's much bigger conversation. And I particularly like the conversation that was going on at Tanya Mosley, where Tanya said, who do you think will be Person of the Year? Wrong answers only, please. Go see that. You will be laughing all weekend.
Don't you love it? Some of those responses are just hilarious.
Really good.
Something else I want to talk with you about that's getting a lot of buzz online. Ben & Jerry's has teamed up with former NFL player Colin Kaepernick, who is still unsigned after he kneeled for the national anthem. They created this new flavor, Change the World, spelled W-H-I-R-L-E-D, with
Very
Kaepernick's
funny.
Portions of the proceeds going to, to Know Your Rights Camp. What are people saying about it? And how does it taste?
All right. Okay. So let's just imagine this. Cookies and caramel sweetly melting in your mouth, and then each scoop laden down with fudge chips, graham cracker and chocolate cookie whirls. And then if you're a vegan like Colin Kaepernick, no problem. This is a non-dairy dessert. Now, not everybody wants social justice dished up with their ice cream. So there's some very bad ice cream puns. But I'm going to give you the last thought to Jason Maxwell, who saw the snark about Ben and Jerry creating activist ice cream and said, I wish I could say I'm surprised at the number of people who are just now realising B&J's political stances, but I am not. I mean, how do you not know before this that B&J is a very liberal company that has taken multiple public stances like this? And good on them for doing it. Now, if you like the sound of Change the World frozen dessert, it's going to be in your local ice cream cabinet from 2021.
Femi Okeh, as always, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Change the World. I'll take a scoop of that. Anyways, earlier this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, told CBS News that he's changing his holiday plans.
We made a decision just a few days ago as a family that for the first time, you know, I have three daughters in their late 20s and early 30s. And for the first time in more than 30 years, I'm not spending the Christmas holidays with my daughters.
But as we saw from Thanksgiving, when millions of people crowded into airports, not everyone will follow Fauci's example. Some researchers argue pandemic fatigue is deepening and the all-or-nothing abstinence approach to health messaging isn't working. Joining us now is Eric Kutcher, an internal medicine physician at NYU Langone Health. Dr. Kutcher, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So no doubt this pandemic is raging out of control, worse than it's really been since the beginning. There's a patchwork of rules in place from state to state, city to city. Some places it's very strict, other places it's not strict at all. Have we gotten to the point where people are just confused? They don't know what to do, or have they just stopped listening?
I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. I think that unfortunately, you know, our public messaging is messy right now, that there are different policies in place in many different places, that some of those are based on evidence and some of those are not. But I also think that the public is really fatigued now more than they have in the past. And I think that it's unfortunate that we've come to rely on policies and quarantines and lockdowns that expect everybody to be perfect with their social distancing. I think there are real reasons why an abstinence approach to COVID-19 doesn't work for many people. There are people who are depressed or have mental health issues or really just feel isolated and come from the social distancing that we've been doing right now. And I think instead of shaming people who aren't able to quarantine perfectly, we have to figure out, okay, if you're not able to stay at home and follow these orders, and then what can we do to keep you and keep others safe at this moment?
Okay, now you're getting to a point that a lot of people are talking about lately, and this is a way of communicating about risk, a concept known as harm reduction. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I think of harm reduction as basically that for those who need to do some sort of behavior that puts them at risk for disease, trying to provide guidance to reduce the harms that can happen. The history of this term really comes from the history of HIV, particularly around IV drug use, where the introduction of needle exchanges, where people would exchange needles to get clean ones so they wouldn't have to share them. But since then, it's really been applied to everything from safer sex to, you know, unhealthy eating, where you talk about decreased access to unhealthy foods. And so I think the same approach, this harm reduction approach, fits very nicely with COVID-19.
I want to underscore this. You are not advocating for people to flout the rules if they think they just can't follow them. You are not telling people to gather in large groups to have a party. What you're saying is if you feel like you need to do something, be as safe as possible about it. But you say that at a time when hospitals are strained, when nurses are and doctors are dying because they're getting infected, they're running out of ICU beds. What are the ethical questions here that people have to face? I mean, when they're deciding whether they should follow the rules strictly or carve out exceptions for themselves, as you say.
Right. ICUs across the country are getting full, and we don't want to, you know, have to go to rationing of care. This is something that shouldn't have to happen in the United States. So if you've been able to abstain, please don't, you know, start doing these behaviors. But if you have been gathering, please, now is a good time to try and think about how to make those behaviors safer.
One of the things I've noticed over the course of this pandemic is that there is a lot of judgment going around. People see others doing something that they wouldn't do. Maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a stranger at the grocery store, and there's, you know, whispering, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're doing this, or I wouldn't do that. That's an aspect about this pandemic that a lot of people don't talk about, shame and stigma. How does that affect people's behavior?
So I don't think that it's productive. And I think in only having an open, fair conversation where you can share knowledge, are you going to be able to make a productive behavior change? And, you know, I'll say as a doctor, I think that some of us in the healthcare setting, we are so tired of working in the hospitals. It's been a complete drain on our healthcare system. And there's a degree of burnout and fatigue and frustration, I think, on our end too. And so I think that often that, you know, we are sometimes some of the loudest people in that shaming. And I think that it's a gut visceral response when we see the burden of this disease and have to deal with it. But I think that the next step is going beyond that to try and say, okay, let me go beyond this and think about how can I engage you in this care and in this pandemic rather than just yell at you about it. And so I'm hopeful that we can have those conversations.
In the spirit of empathy for other human beings, doctor, that this stuff is all hard no matter how you cut it. You know, you mentioned that healthcare professionals feel so overburdened and tired of what's going on. Could you share some decisions you've had to make in your own personal life that others, you know, might look at and say, well, geez, you shouldn't have done that, or maybe you should have reconsidered, but for you, it was the right thing to do?
So, you know, I haven't seen my parents, basically. I didn't see them from March until July. In July, I realized, you know, I can't not see them anymore. And at that point, the case numbers in New York City were fairly low. And so I decided that I would go and visit my parents. And we did a weekend together. My partner came with me. And the entire time, we wore KN95 masks, which are a little bit more protective. And then we only ate outdoors more than 6 feet apart. My parents have a backyard that we were able to do that in. And the rest of the time we tried to be as distanced, but allowed to be in each other's presence. And so I think, you know, my own personal behaviors, I'd say, in many scenarios are a little bit more precautious. But I also think that's because as a healthcare worker, I'm in a higher risk category. And so I don't use my behavior as a model for others to follow. Instead, I really think that, you know, other people who don't have access to the same resources are going to have to make very different decisions.
Dr. Eric Kutcher, thank you very much. The price of oil has been on a wild ride this year. After a supply glut, an international price war, and a cratering of demand because of COVID, prices are low, which is good for drivers, but not so much for the tens of thousands of people in West Texas who work in the oil industry. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has the story.
Brody Pinkerton stands in the equipment yard of Maverick Well Pluggers, sees a lot of work that needs to be done.
This one's actually just a little maintenance, honestly. I mean, there's so many moving parts on a rig like this. I mean, there's so many moving parts that can break. Radiator's pretty simple fix.
Pinkerton co-owns this Midland, Texas company, which plugs unproductive or abandoned wells for oil producers. Last year, it was so busy, these mammoth 40-foot-long, 10-wheeled workover rigs were fixed at the oil well. Now, much of their equipment sits idle here. Each piece stacked in lots across Midland and neighboring Odessa represent lost revenue. Oil producers needed to slash expenses and contacted companies like Pinkerton's to try and cut the prices of existing contracts.
They were sending essentially demand letters of, if you want to keep doing work for us right now, you're going to submit new prices with us if, at least 25%. We'd really like to see 30% reduction. And I'm calling them saying, look, we don't make 30% profit on this stuff. And it was kind of like, well, figure it out.
Maverick laid off half its 60-person staff. Owners didn't draw paychecks for 6 months.
Like I said, right now we're just limping along, maintaining what we've got, hoping that it'll get better.
This part of Texas, called the Permian Basin, is the most productive oil region in the nation, and it screeched to a halt in April. Kirk Edwards of Latigo Petroleum says the area had over 400 rigs and dropped to around 100 at its lowest.
And those rigs usually have 100 people with them, so it's 35,000 minimum people that we've lost just on the drilling rig side of things.
That's about a third of the oil field jobs lost nationally. The city of Odessa went from the lowest unemployment in the state to the highest at over 13%. Renee Earls leads the Odessa Chamber of Commerce.
We talk about here in Odessa and the Permian Basin that no matter what industry you're in, we're all in the oil industry together.
All those people out of work means empty temporary housing. The unemployment means belt tightening across the community, she says. The barn door in Odessa is open, but restaurant owner Roy Gillian says it's doing just a third of what it used to. And its catering business is even worse.
We would drive, 100 miles and go out into an oil field and, charge them by the mile, of course, and go out there and maybe cook steaks on our trailer for them. And all of that has gone away.
People have had difficulty paying bills, too. At Complex Community Federal Credit Union, President Jason Barrage says they've allowed customers to defer payments on $60 million in loans. He's not worried yet, because they've all been through this before.
That's part of being out in the oil economy. You know it's going to go up, and you make hay while the sun shines, but it's going to go back down. And you just got to get ready when it's down to start making hay again when it comes back up.
According to the Dallas Federal Reserve, economists believe this is even worse than the oil bust of the 80s. It took property values in some West Texas cities 30 years to recover from that bust.
I think it's going to get worse.
Drew McGannigal lost his family's Odessa energy business in the 80s bust. He's in Houston and has a new job, helping companies restructure and go through bankruptcy. Business is good right now, and he's worried about his hometown.
And sad, it brings me no joy to say this, but I think they're in for some really rough times.
Everyone's just hoping they can hang on long enough to see another boom. For NPR News, I'm Paul Flav in Odessa, Texas.
Three years ago, the strongest earthquake to hit Mexico in decades destroyed large parts of southern Mexico, including a vital community center focused on preserving the regional culture and music of Veracruz, known as Son Jarocho. That's when singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade, who lives nearby, decided to step in.
Desde que vi tus ojos me enamoré, me enamoré, me enamoré. Desde que oí tu canto sabía que no había manera de abandonarte, mi amor, porque toda la luz y colores de un cielo azul haces brillar, eres tú.
With the help of musicians from Mexico, Lafourcade put together a fundraising album called Un Canto por México, with all proceeds benefiting the reconstruction of this important center. And it's been a big hit, winning the Latin Grammy's Album of the Year Award with special recognition of Lafourcade's original song, Mi Religión. Joining me now from her home in Veracruz is Natalia Lafourcade. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Congratulations on winning the Album of the Year. I know this album is especially important to you, a portion of the proceeds going to charity. How did the album and the decision to give away the proceeds come about?
This project was made in order to support this cause, which has to do with rebuild this community center that has place in Jaltipan, Veracruz. And this place works a lot with Son Jarocho and all the tradition that is around the Son Jarocho music and tradition. So this album was made because of that. And then we decided to put into this piece of music all the people that will be able to bring that Mexican sound and essence into this music and this project. So it's been an amazing thing because I believe that this album is not just about me working my music and working my songs, but it has this Mexican spirit and this Mexican thing that is not only me, but many, many people involved in this.
Yeah, yeah. You wrote Mi Religión, which we heard at the top, and it's a love song to Veracruz, and it's a musical tradition of San Jarocho. Let's play a clip of the song, El Balahu. You've said that in many ways your musical trajectory actually led you to singing this traditional song. How so?
Yeah, well, For me, it was very special to work on this piece of music because the first time that I had the opportunity to sing live was with traditional music from Mexico, right? Like I had a mariachi behind me supporting my singing, and I remember how, I never forgot how that felt. And of course I was very nervous, and I was at a certain point I was also like super panic, and I remember my whole body was shaking, and I was super, super nervous. But there was a moment, and it was only two songs, right? But it was traditional music from Mexico. And I remember like having this feeling and thinking, wow, this music is amazing. And I never want to go down the stage. And this is my place. Like, this is the thing that I want to do forever. And then I was keeping in my mind that I wanted to make a ranchero album once in my life or twice, I don't know. Like, I was thinking I wouldn't have the chance to work with this kind of music. So when we were thinking about making Un Canto por México, I was thinking that it was probably the right time to mix that ginger with my style, you know, and the way I normally approach to music and make a mix between both worlds, right? One that is my universe and the other one that is all these wonderful people and musicians coming to my universe. And I think that that is the reason it became so rich and so special and so magic, because when I listen to Un Canto por México, it tastes like mole, like maíz, like you know, like our traditional food. And you can feel like the landscapes that you see in Mexico, like if you go from the north to the south, you can see like those places in the music.
Your description, it's like having mole. I think that really brings home the sentiment of what you're saying here, that richness there, that deepness of culture. I want to go to some of your classics. Let's take a listen to Mujer Divina, this classic you made new again a decade ago. If you could see me now, I'm kind of like swaying back and forth. It's such a cool tune. You know, I wonder if you think of yourself as an archivist of traditional music. Do you see yourself this way?
There was a moment when I had to approach other composers because I needed to learn and because I wanted to become a greater writer and songwriter, you know. I had like that feeling inside, so I was like, I feel like I want to work with Agustín Lara's music and make an album that will be that music which comes from long ago but new and from this era, and that young people will be like I want to listen to this music because it's fresh. But at the same time, it has this old soul and feeling. Yeah.
Natalia, it's really interesting to hear you talk about how you want to do what these other composers are doing, being honest and pure in their work. And that is what you're doing. I think that is what you're doing. Do you see it that way?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty to see the impact that music has. Now, and how you work on a thing without knowing what is going to happen after you finish, and once you release the thing, and people can see it and people can hear it, and then you don't have it the control, really, of what's going to happen next. But then you see how that impacts others. And I think that's what music does.
You're working on a second album to follow up on Un Canto por México, which is coming out in spring of 2021. What's something you're working on for this new album that you're excited and eager to share with more audiences?
Well, I think it makes me very proud that both albums are beautiful. And also we decided not to release this album until this community center that we are building, it's done. It's well done. So this incredible place in Veracruz, to know that next year, if everything goes well the way we think, like just as it's been happening, the kids are going to be able to go back and use this place for keep working on music and doing amazing projects. And this place is going to keep doing its work, you know, because they have been working for like more than 20 years on the music and on keeping like the traditional and Son Jarocho and making more people know about it. So we just made the decision of wait until it's well done so we can release the piece of music and it will be like a celebration, like a big celebration for us.
Natalia Lafourcade, Latin Grammy winner and musician, thank you so much for this conversation.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Chicken nuggets made from animal cells grown in a lab could soon be on sale in Singapore. Yeah, that's right. Meat created in a laboratory. Food regulators in Singapore recently approved the product, which was cooked up by a startup in San Francisco called Eat Just. The lab meat still has a long way to go until it's widely available, and we've got lots of questions for the company's CEO, Josh Tetrick. Josh, welcome.
Good to be here.
So, fair to say, I think, this is a pretty unusual product. What is this meat that you're trying to sell now in Singapore?
We call this cultivated meat or no-kill meat. And essentially what it is real chicken meat, high-quality chicken meat full of protein and the other nutrients you would expect in chicken without all the issues, without the deforestation, without the food safety risk, and without the animal welfare issues. And we take a single cell, we identify nutrients to feed that cell, and we can manufacture meat in a new and in a better way. And this whole process will start in Singapore, and we hope it'll catch on to the rest of the world.
So this product is very different than the plant-based meat alternatives that are hitting the market, because this actually is meat. This would not be for vegetarians.
Correct. It would be for vegetarians if philosophically they're not eating meat because they're concerned about the morality issues and the environmental issues, and this would definitely be for them. But I think your sentiment is right. This is for people who eat meat around the world. There are about 67 billion chickens that we consume every single year, and those chickens also consume a lot of food, a lot of soy and corn, which leads to a lot of deforestation. And we shouldn't have to deal with all that to have a chicken dinner with our families, right? Mm-hmm. We can have real high-quality meat without killing an animal, without tearing down a forest, without exacerbating climate change, without increasing the probability of another zoonotic disease. And that's exactly what this is.
What can you tell us about how you actually do this inside the lab?
So if you think about how normal meat or conventional meat is made, you've got a whole bunch of chickens and they eat a whole lot of soy and corn. And then after about 40 days, we kill the chickens, we chop it up, and we eat it. What we do is we take the good part about that, which is the cell of a chicken, and we discard all the bad stuff. So we take a single cell from a chicken. We can get that from a biopsy, from a fresh piece of meat, from a cell bank. Then we identify nutrients to feed that cell. So think amino acids, other vitamins and minerals. And then we scale it up, where we actually manufacture the meat at scale, in a piece of equipment called a bioreactor. And it's a culturing process that's not that dissimilar from how you might think about brewing beer. And then the end product is real high-quality chicken or beef or pork or whatever cell line that we're working on, and we're pretty excited about it.
My, oh my, does it taste the same?
It tastes like chicken. And sometimes people are a little bit disappointed when they try it, because I think they're thinking it's going to taste like super chicken, like it's going to be a better tasting chicken. So we often disappoint them when they try. It's just chicken, because it is chicken. And as you said, it is distinct from a lot of the great plant-based products out there that are made with plant-based materials. The single ingredient here is chicken. So if you had a chicken allergy, you shouldn't eat our chicken bites or chicken nuggets. It's not for you.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say you're probably still years away from having this be widespread, maybe longer. But one of the issues you may be facing, and I don't know how to ask this question other than just to say, I'm a meat eater, and to be honest, my first reaction to this idea was physical, almost like, you know, that's not right. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who would need to get over some kind of an ick factor. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that. I can't put my head in the sand and pretend that everyone's going to hear this and say, all right, I'm hungry for that chicken. And I think it's our job to walk through the door that this regulatory approval has given us, to scale the product up, and to importantly talk to consumers openly about what it is. It's non-GMO. There's no engineering happening here. If you compare the microbiological content, E. coli, salmonella, et cetera, to conventional chicken, this is worlds better. It's important to be open with consumers about what conventional meat and conventional chicken looks like. So we're not living in a fantasy world when we're having our own chicken dinner, right? And it's our belief that that if we're open about it, if we don't try to hide the ball, if people ultimately see that this tastes as good or better, that it's significantly safer, ultimately it's more affordable, and the world just needs it. You know, we're taking the bet if we communicate in that way and we really let people into the process that in a handful of decades in the future, the majority of the chicken and the beef and the pork that we consume won't require killing a single animal.
A handful of decades. So these are the early days of meat grown in this way. Josh Tetrick, CEO of Eat Just, a company that has just recently gotten approval to start selling its meat grown in a lab. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
Countries with powerful economies are racing to get vaccines to the public. But what happens in countries without the economic might of the United States? That's next time on Here and Now.